year is 2022, and the news media most of us grew up with is all but dead. Advancements in technology have forever altered the nature of news and political news coverage. Network, cable, and online news organizations value speed over accuracy and cater their reporting to specific ideological and demographic groups. They lean hard into storylines that stimulate their base and avoid reporting stories that run counter to their preferred narratives. The result is an ever-expanding partisan divide within an inadequately informed populace. A cultural civil war is brewing. Two rogue journalistic purists stand opposed and have dedicated themselves to protecting journalistic integrity and the relentless pursuit of truth. Their names are Liz Habib and John Ziegler, and this is their podcast, The Death of Journalism.
Welcome to episode 22 of the Death of Journalism podcast. I am your host and currently your only host. My name is John Ziegler. We've got several major topics on today's show, all of them very compelling. The Speaker of the House saga, is Donald Trump really done? Biden goes to the border. King Gavin Newsom's mental illness becomes a bigger issue during his inauguration. The NFL completely loses its mind, as does the media, over the Damar Hamlin situation. And Prince Harry makes the U.S. media rounds to promote his new revenge book on the British royal family. But first, we begin with that saga involving the election for the Speaker of the House. We talked a lot about this in episode number 21. It took 15 ballots in the end before Kevin McCarthy, as had always been expected, was finally elected as the Speaker of the House. This took on almost the feel of an old-time papal election. I was half expecting, when McCarthy finally got the votes, for there to be white smoke coming out of the House of Representatives and for someone to declare Habemus Papam. I guess in this case it would be Habemus Dissentis, although my Latin is terrible. I'm not sure that that's correct. Probably is not. But the bottom line is we have a Speaker. And the real question here is, what kind of damage did this process cause for this Republican Congress, which has an incredibly small margin, if non-existent margin of error? The way they're trying to spin it right now is kind of the what doesn't kill you makes you stronger philosophy, which, by the way, I think there's something theoretically to that under certain circumstances. If someone survives a near-death situation, like Damar Hamlin, we'll get to that shortly, and they are okay, then they can actually be seen as in a stronger position, because if someone tried to take them out and they failed, they can be seen as almost unstoppable or unbeatable, or you want to stay away from them because they've already survived once or twice, kind of the Rasputin theory of politics. I don't know if that's what's really going to happen here, because in order to get this compromise, to get enough votes, and he barely got enough votes to be declared Speaker, he had to give up a lot of concessions. He had to give up a lot of his power. He had to make it easier for those who don't like him to get rid of him. I frankly think the main reason why he eventually won was because there was no viable alternative. If there had been, someone would have emerged before the 15 ballots. But instead, no one ever came close to him. And I think the most dangerous thing that happened here for this Republican Congress was that the rebels, the 19, 20, 21 or so Republican Congress people who refused to get in line for various reasons, almost all of whom were very strong Trump supporters who defied Donald Trump's endorsement of Kevin McCarthy, by and large, they were rewarded. And in some ways, they were very dramatically rewarded. So I don't know how that can possibly play well with the 200 or so loyalists. If you're one of the loyalists and you're looking at the rebels causing all this problem and embarrassment and dysfunction, and then at least some of them end up getting rewarded for what they did, I don't know how, if you look at this in military terms, you can maintain command and control, especially when you have so little leverage with such a small majority in the House of Representatives. So I do believe that this narrative, this media narrative, that there's going to be a major problem for Kevin McCarthy and the Republican Congress is based on a reality. Now, how much of a reality, I don't know. I think the key is, does McCarthy get a couple of victories early on? If he gets a couple of victories early on and gets some momentum and shows that he can actually do the job and get some things done, although the Congress itself has very little power now. See, that's part of the problem here, is because Biden is the president and the Democrats control the Senate, and they basically eviscerated much of the congressional House of Representatives' power to begin with, a lot of this is academic. And that's partially why the rebels knew what they were doing had very little cost, because a lot of this is just for show. It's just academic. It's just for them to increase their popularity among their far-right base, increase their profile. I mean, Matt Gaetz, who I guess turns out to be one of the big winners here, is just a flaming dick. That's what he is. And it appears as if he won here. And after the 14th ballot, Mike Rogers, one Republican congressman, almost got in a fight on the House floor with Gaetz, because it appeared as if, I guess, it seems as if he did not abide by the compromise or the deal that he had made. But Gaetz doesn't care, because Gaetz is a right-wing star. You know, the right-wing media outlets love him. He's got lots of a big following on social media. He doesn't need the party. In the olden days, there were meaning like 20 years ago, there was no alternative for someone like a Matt Gaetz to be able to survive, to be able to maintain themselves. They would have had to rely on the party. And if the party abandoned them, they would have gotten creamed in a primary, and they wouldn't have had the ability to fight back, because there wasn't social media and there weren't right-wing media outlets. They would fall in love with a guy like this. So the environment has completely changed, and it has consequences. And look, I mean, I'm somebody who stands on principle all the time, even against my own self-interest. But the reality is, you had to elect a speaker, and you have to function. And sometimes you got to go along with things you don't agree with. And sometimes that means voting for people that you're not in love with, because there's no perfect options when you have such a small majority. That's the reality of the situation. Ironically, Democrats understood that under Nancy Pelosi, but Republicans do not understand that in the Trump era. And I do believe that Trump is a huge part of this equation, although ironically, and I think tellingly, Trump had very, very little, if any, power to try to rectify this situation. He even came out and re-endorsed McCarthy, and it had no impact. It didn't move one vote. So, as has happened so often, Republicans get none of the benefit of having a Donald Trump and all of the negative of having Donald Trump be such a huge piece of the Republican Party, and even to this day. Now, I'll get more to Trump and an interesting article that was in the New York Intelligencer about him that may have been trying to write his obituary, probably too soon, but I'll get to that momentarily. But as far as the speakership is concerned, look, I hope Kevin McCarthy does a great job, because this is a really important situation. But I fear that we are going to have a situation where we could have a government default, because the rebels that did this time are going to see very little impact or negative consequences for doing it again, and they will have the power to do so. And there's not much that can be done. That's the problem. So this is a wait-and-see situation. I'm glad that the situation has at least been temporarily fixed, and that there's a speaker, and that it happened, you know, after a couple of days with very little short-term damage. But this is not a problem that has been fixed by any stretch of the imagination. Now, it happened very, very late night, in fact, technically in the morning, on January 7th. I know some people were hoping that it would happen on January 6th, because that, of course, has now become a religious holiday on the left, because that's the anniversary of the so-called insurrection or the riot of Capitol Hill 2 years ago that was as a result of the 2020 presidential election. And, you know, my position on the Capitol Hill riots has been somewhat nuanced, as it often is, meaning very few people actually agree with me. I think it was horrendous. It was an embarrassment to the country. It was horrifying to watch. I was embarrassed as an American. It made me even more infuriated at Donald Trump than I had been previously. I was in favor of Trump being impeached for what happened there, which he was. But with that said, Democrats in the news media have completely overplayed their hand on that particular situation for basically the last 2 years. And that's why I refer to it as a religious holiday. I've even joked that liberal public schools have started masking again after Christmas holiday as deference to the religious holiday of January the 6th. So, you know, it's a religious holiday on the left, and we mark that by forcing kids to mask in schools in liberal inner city public school systems. But the part about this where I really draw the line, it's not just overplaying their hand. It's not just giving it a massive amount of news coverage that is probably more than it deserves, but it's gotten into the realm of flat out lying and myth making. And we saw that on January 6th, where both President Biden and Hakeem Jeffries, who is now the minority leader in the House of Representatives, both of them just flat out fabricated what actually happened on January 6th. Now, Biden did it with a little bit more nuance, a little bit more subtlety, a little bit more difficult to call it a blatant lie than Jeffries did. But they're continuing, and the media helps them with this. The media does nothing to push back against this. They basically, the left has the, and the Democrats have the full ability to just fabricate whatever myth that they want regarding January 6th. And the greatest, most obviously false myth is this idea that many law enforcement officers, Capitol Hill police, lost their lives that day because of the riots and the protests. That is not true. That is not true. There is not one person who directly died or was killed because of those protests on that day. It did not happen. Now, if you parse what President Biden says very, very carefully, he never actually says in general that Capitol Hill police officers were killed by protesters. He creates that impression both in tone and in some of the facts that he leaves out. But on January 6th, in this commemoration of this now religious holiday, Biden very strongly implied that numerous police officers were killed because of the riots, which is not true. Jeffries went even further and said that five, the number is now up to five, law enforcement officials were killed in the Capitol Hill riots, which is a flat-out lie. That did not happen. The only person that was directly killed that day, and this is an absolute fact, and obviously I am no Trump fan, but the only person that was killed that day was Ashley Babbitt, who was a woman who was there to protest, and she was shot and killed by law enforcement that day. And I can guarantee you, if the shoes were reversed, the situation was reversed, the shoe was on the other foot, whatever cliche you want to use, if everything was reversed, and this was a liberal protest, and Ashley Babbitt, for God forbid she was black, was killed by a white police officer, regardless of what Babbitt was doing, the entire country would know her name. It would be a George Floyd situation. And instead, no one knows her name except on the right. Her mother even got arrested trying to visit the site on January 6th in a way that seemed rather inappropriate based upon the video of it that went online. But that's the one person that got killed. And she was a protester. So I really don't like this lying. I hate this lying and this myth making. My gosh, by the time we hit to the 10th anniversary of January 6th, this thing's going to be worse than Sandy Hook. It might even be 9/11 level of casualties. And it's just not true. But the media does absolutely nothing to push back against it. It's like carte blanche. Go ahead. You guys do whatever you want to do. We're just going to sit back on our hands and go, yeah, horrible. It was really horrible that day. Yes, it was horrible, but let's not lie about it. Let's not lie about what actually happened here. Unfortunately, lying is now just accepted if the lie is for the right purpose in the minds of the left-wing media. Now, speaking of lying, I've got to mention King Gavin Newsom, our governor here in California, who still to this day, as of right now, is effectively a king because he declared a state of emergency back when COVID began, based on a total, complete lie, a lie that I documented the very next day as a senior columnist for Mediaite. You can Google that. Total, complete lie about how many people were going to get COVID in what period of time. It wasn't even remotely close. It was an obvious lie. And he has maintained that state of emergency for almost 3 years now. Now, supposedly he's going to end it in February, but that state of emergency makes him effectively a monarch, a king. It ends democracy. He can do almost anything he wants without even legislative approval, which, of course, here in California is not a big deal for him because there's effectively no Republican Party. But on January 6th, he got inaugurated for his second term. How many he's going to end up with, who knows? Because after all, you know, democracy doesn't seem to matter to him or to the state of California or to the pathetic media we have here in California. But the reality is he gets to not only get away with that, he gets to claim to be on the 100%, 180 degrees opposite side of the ledger on this issue. I mean, he gets to claim in his inauguration speech that he is a fighter for freedom, that he is a fighter for democracy. I mean, this is gaslighting to the nth degree. This is the ultimate example of something that a lot of people have complained about for a long time. And this has been since politics began, but I've seen it a lot more recently, where there one of the great ploys that you can do is to claim that you are the opposite of what you really are, to accuse the other side of doing what you are actually doing. And this was just too rich to ignore. So this is a portion, a small portion of King Gavin Newsom's inauguration speech on January 6th, where he pretends to be a freedom fighter. And this is not just taken out of context. This is not just a clip. This is a small clip, about 30 seconds of a much larger element of the speech, which was the entire theme of the speech and in the entire theme of what he tweeted about the speech. It's just complete and total insanity, but I feel like I gotta play it for you. So here that is.
All camouflaged under the hijacking of the word freedom. But what they really want, you know this, is more control, intrusive government, command over your most intimate decisions, when to have a family, how to raise your kids, how to love. And while they cry freedom, they dictate the choices. They dictate the choices people are allowed to make, fanning the flames of these exhaustive culture wars.
Now, right after Newsom went on that spiel about what a freedom fighter he is and how terrible Republicans are on this issue of freedom, the first thing he talked about was making abortion illegal, which is another lie, because that's not what the Supreme Court did. The Supreme Court did not make abortion illegal. It allowed the states to do what they want with regard to abortion law. And every state basically in the whole country now has a very different law on abortion. It's almost nowhere is it actually 100% made illegal. It's certainly not in California, and there's no threat that it's going to happen in California. But this was particularly rich. I mean, there's so many things that are hypocritical about what Newsom tried to do in that inauguration speech that I could probably spend 3 hours in this podcast on it if I wanted to. But I raise abortion, one, because it's at least a fabrication, if not a lie. But this is the same guy. We're talking about medical freedom here. This is the same guy who just signed a brand new law making it illegal for doctors to provide their opinion on COVID treatments to their patients if their opinion differs from what is allowed by the state. Under the realm or the guise of quote-unquote misinformation, it is illegal in California for a doctor to provide quote-unquote COVID misinformation to their patients. In the real world, that means an opinion that differs from what the state has approved. A state that has been wrong almost every single time for the last 3 years. That's the real Gavin Newsom. That's the guy who doesn't believe in freedom at all. That's the guy who certainly doesn't believe in medical freedom. This is also the guy who threatened, declared, bragged that he was going to force every public school student in the state to get vaccinated for COVID before they were allowed to go to public school. Now he quietly backed away from that, and hopefully has permanently backed away from that, because it's politically, I believe, unviable even for him in a one-party state. But that's what he was going to do. I mean, he declared that was going to be the case. That caused a massive amount of tension in my family. That was going to be something that was going to be an impossible situation for me, my wife, and our two daughters, because my wife was not going to allow our daughters to be vaccinated over her dead body. And I didn't know what the heck our other options were going to be. He caused out of nothing, eventually, a massive amount of tension in our family, and I'm sure tens of, if not hundreds of thousands of other families in the state, all because he wanted to prove that he was the leader on this issue of fighting COVID. Now, of course, there's so many other elements of this bogus narrative that somehow he's pro-freedom. I mean, this is the guy that shut down our schools. This is the guy that mandated masks all over the place, shut down beaches. This is the guy who shut down businesses. They shut down playgrounds. This is the freedom guy. This is the world we're living in. This is the 180 degrees from reality. This is the pretend world that now exists because our media, especially here in California, is completely broken. No mainstream news media pushback against this narrative at all. And I would like to believe that what's motivating it is that Newsom understands, even he understands that this is a weakness for him. That if he decides to run for president in 2024, this is something that he could be attacked on. And so he's trying to make a vulnerability, a weakness, into a strength, knowing that the news media will at least let him get away with it, if not carry his water for him. Now, I don't know whether or not he's really going to run in 2024. A lot of people believe that that is his motivation. It certainly is consistent with that motivation. I know he would love to be president. It's obvious he's an egomaniac. I don't know what his path is, because he can't really go after Biden if Biden decides to run for reelection. So if Biden runs, that is pretty much sealed off, because you're not going to beat an incumbent president unless Biden just becomes medically, basically unable to form a sentence. Some people would argue that he can't do that now, but I mean, I don't think he's nearly to that point yet. So unless this becomes just completely ridiculous and nobody's willing to take him on other than Newsom, I could see a path there, but I don't see how that's realistic unless that's the circumstance. The other scenario, of course, is that Biden decides not to run in 2024, but then I believe Newsom is blocked by Kamala Harris. I do not see how, even as terrible a candidate as Kamala Harris is, I do not see how you can possibly, as a white male, win a woke Democratic primary by running against a black female who's been vice president for 4 years or 3 years at that point, and she's from your own state. I mean, that would be against the woke religion to even run against her. And I mean, so yes, she's terrible. Yes, she is terrible. But I would find it very hard to believe that he could pull that off. And as I've stated previously on this podcast, if you look at the states, the early states that determine who a nominee on the presidential side is going to be, I do not think they favor Gavin Newsom in any way, shape, or form. But look, we're living in a world where almost anything's possible. So in his mind, this may be his motivation. But I thought that was certainly worthy of mention, and the absurdity and the hypocrisy that now is just normal everyday behavior in 2023 America. Now, President Biden made his first trip to the border, which I found to be particularly ironic since he was going to El Paso, Texas. And we talked in episode 21 about El Paso, Texas being in a state of emergency over illegal immigration, and how a radio sportscaster from North Carolina State's sportscaster Gary Hahn had been suspended indefinitely because he made, I guess, a joke about how El Paso, the site of the Sun Bowl, was being overrun by illegal aliens, which was 100% factually true. But the part about this that I found interesting from a media perspective is not just the fact that obviously the news media always downplays the issue of illegal immigration, and the language they use is incredibly benign, and you're not allowed to say illegal aliens. Apparently, even if you're a radio sportscaster in North Carolina, you have to say undocumented immigrants or something else. Whatever, I don't know even what the accepted language is today. But you know, the media is completely in the tank when it comes to the issue of illegal immigration. But in this particular case, the pictures and the videos online that the media has systematically ignored, the mainstream media has systematically ignored, about how El Paso was literally cleaned up for this trip to the border. Now, allegedly, this is for Biden to be able to see how bad things are, right? But in 24 hours, They were able to clean up the airport and clean up many of the streets. Obviously, I'm sure not to 100% satisfaction, but they were able to clean this up enough to where it would be somewhat presentable for Joe Biden. And these are clear cut pictures and videos all over the place, but that's not of interest to the news media. If Donald Trump was in a similar situation, this would all be all the news media would talk about. 100%. The creating of a false narrative, this fictional world, we're cleaning everything up just for the president to be able to claim that things aren't as bad as they really are. But that's not the world we live in, because the media is completely in the tank for Joe Biden. Now, as far as Donald Trump, I referenced an article in the New York Intelligencer that came out a few days ago. And there were so many interesting parts of this that I think are worthy of mention. One of which was, I was stunned that I was not even aware that this existed for at least 2 days after it was published. And that might be the most telling element of where Donald Trump currently is. Because based upon the content of this, I would have thought this would have gone super viral on both the left and the right. But that did not happen, as far as I can tell. This is a column or an article or feature written by a woman by the name of Olivia Nuzzi. Now, Olivia Nuzzi has written a lot about Trump over the years. I believe that Trump has a little bit of a crush on her. For a writer, she's rather attractive, and we all know that how important that is to Trump. But she's obviously a liberal. I had one friend of mine who has been in the Trump orbit, been trying to get out of the Trump orbit, who was confused as to why Trump would give an interview to Olivia Nuzzi. And my theory was just as I said, that Trump finds her attractive. And this person said, you know what, that probably makes sense. They also said that doesn't explain Maggie Haberman of the New York Times, who's not attractive, and Trump also seems to have taken a liking to. And I said, no, that's about the New York Times kissing his ass. So in the Nuzzi situation, it's a beautiful woman, or at least an attractive woman, kissing his ass. And effectively, it's the same thing with Maggie Haberman, only the woman there is the New York Times. And in Trump's world, when he grew up, the New York Times was the ultimate be-all, end-all. So anyone from the New York Times kissing his ass automatically is arousing to him. And that's clearly what's impacting his actions. So he gives this interview and this remarkable access at Mar-a-Lago to Olivia Nuzzi from the New York Intelligencer. And Nuzzi just completely obliterates Trump in this article. And the bottom line takeaway is that Trump is alone. He is lost. He is sad. He is pathetic. He is lifeless. He's basically stuck in Mar-a-Lago talking, to people at weddings. when they host the wedding at Mar-a-Lago, he'll show up and give speeches and take pictures. It's almost like, he is stuck there in Mar-a-Lago, and that there is no actual presidential campaign. He's in exile in Mar-a-Lago. That the people that are working around him are at best the D-list, that even key members of his own family have no interest in this 2024 election, and that it's possible that this is all being done as a way to try to prevent being indicted, a theory I've never fully bought into, but that's a theory that on the left gets a lot of popularity, that somehow Trump believes that by running for president, at least in name, that this might make it less likely for him to be indicted because it'll be seen as an inherently political prosecution. But the reality is that this column had to infuriate Trump. This, and I call it a column, it's more of a feature story, but it was obviously very much laden with opinions. And the opinion seemed to be that Trump is done, that he can still cause havoc, that he can still potentially even bring down the whole country. I should mention that in the sub headline of this article, they do reference that he could still win, that just because he's lonely and lost doesn't mean he can't win, because he still has that kind of hold over the base of the Republican Party. And that's kind of where I am. I mean, my view has slightly shifted in the last month or so from the midterm elections. And, you know, in a rational world, he would be completely done. I was not impressed by his announcement, either in the timing or in the execution of his announcement to run for president. But I still fear him. I still fear him as a force. I fear him mostly as a force as to what he would do to the Republican nominee if it's not him. I don't think it's impossible for him to win the nomination. Obviously, if Ron DeSantis doesn't run, then Donald Trump is a heavy, heavy favorite to be the Republican nominee in 2024. If DeSantis does run, I think that DeSantis probably beats him. But the key questions are, at what cost, and would Trump sabotage him in the general election? And it is still my view that the cost of beating Trump would be substantial, and that the most likely scenario is that Trump would indeed sabotage him in a general election. Now, one of the things I kept thinking about when reading this feature is, when is Trump, from a strategic standpoint, and why hasn't he already, but when is Trump going to finally pull the trigger on his Twitter account? I mean, this is a guy who has almost 90 million followers on Twitter and is becoming seen as at least impotent, if not totally irrelevant, because he's not on Twitter, even though he's been allowed back on by Elon Musk. And maybe he's waiting for the right moment, which strategically would make sense. Or maybe he's just has his hands completely tied legally because of his Truth Social platform, which he at least owns at least part of, if not most of. And therefore, he is legally restricted from tweeting. If that's the case, then he doesn't scare me nearly as much as he might otherwise, because I think Trump needs his Twitter feed. I think Trump needs his Twitter feed to cause havoc, to keep his cult in line, to be able to reward commentators that favor him, to punish commentators and or politicians who cross him. That Twitter feed is extremely powerful in this day and age. Now, it's, you know, it shouldn't be. It's mostly just perception, but that's the world we live in. And so I think that's maybe the number one question here. Is Trump totally prevented from using his Twitter feed, or is he just waiting? If he's totally prevented, then without that weapon, then I think he is eminently beatable in the Republican primary, and his ability to sabotage, while it's still there, might not be as great. Although, remember, the media is much more threatened by Ron DeSantis as president than they would be by Donald Trump winning the Republican nomination. The media would love Donald Trump to win the Republican nomination because it gives them everything they possibly want, including another Democratic victory, not just at the presidential level, but probably at the senatorial and congressional levels as well. So they're going to be doing nothing to hinder Donald Trump. They might even be blowing the wind at his back should that scenario occur. And, you know, that's unfortunately something that people have to consider. So I'm still not optimistic about how this is all going to turn out, but I did find the New York Intelligencer feature to be particularly interesting. And, you know, I'm not willing to write his death note as yet. I think that Donald Trump is still very much alive. He still controls a huge portion of the Republican base or his cult, and I do not trust what he is going to do with that. But obviously, this will be an ongoing topic of this, the Death of Journalism podcast. Now, shifting gears to by far the biggest story of the last week or so in the United States of America, to what happened with the NFL football player, Buffalo Bills, DeMar Hamlin. And we spoke a lot about this in episode 21 of the Death of Journalism podcast. Obviously, on a Monday night football game against the Cincinnati Bengals, he collapsed live on the air on Monday night football, and it appeared as if he was going to die. He had a cardiac arrest. There was CPR given to him for about 9 minutes on the field. It looked very, very grim. After about an hour delay, the game was at first postponed and eventually completely canceled. Now, on our last podcast, I had a pretty good sense that he was going to live for whatever reason, I've been 2 for 2 recently in predicting these situations. I said that Mike Leach was going to die before Mike Leach did, and I said that DeMar Hamlin was going to live before it was clear that DeMar Hamlin was going to live, partially because with DeMar Hamlin, you had a 24-year-old in outstanding physical shape who got immediate expert medical attention, which saved his life. There was no indication that anything like that had happened to Mike Leach, who was 61 and not in particularly great shape. And I don't know if what caused either of those two situations was exactly the same or even remotely the same, but that was just my sense of what was going to happen. I also could tell that Hamlin's situation was not imminently going to cause death by the body language of the coaches and those who were around when the phone call came in to postpone the game on that Monday night. Now, obviously and understandably, Hamlin got an enormous amount of support from the public and really got a ton of support from the media and from the NFL and all of the other teams in the league. And all that is great. All that is wonderful and understandable. And it is awesome, amazing, that it appears as if Hamlin is going to make a very significant, if not a full recovery at this point. It's fantastic. It's a great story. And nobody, including myself, wants to rain on that parade. It's great. However, in many ways, this thing has gone too far. I said in the last episode that when there is a lack of information, let the virtue signaling begin. And boy, was I right about that, because we have seen a week's worth of virtue signaling run amok. And it's not just annoying. It has actual repercussions. There are consequences for doing things purely on raw emotion and by virtue signaling. And let me give you some examples with regard to the DeMar Hamlin circumstance. So the NFL postponed that game at first. Then they canceled it. But that caused a massive problem, because now, because these two teams were vying for the number one seed in the AFC, this made the NFL have a massive problem with what to do with the playoffs, because now the Bills and the Bengals haven't played the full complement of 17 games in a season. Now, to me, while the game should not have been permanently canceled, I believe that in a rational world, a world where we weren't awash in virtue signaling, where the media was thinking about this remotely rationally instead of showing everybody how much virtue they have and how it's completely inappropriate to even talk about playing this game, in a rational world, here's what would have happened. Okay? I'm trying to be as understanding as possible to the emotions that were at play here, because this person appeared to die on live television right in the middle of a game. So I'm being, I think, very sensitive to that, having been a high school football coach and covered college and pro football and been a football fan my whole life. What should have happened was the commissioner should have said, okay, we are going to postpone this game till tomorrow afternoon. All right, because by Monday night, it was clear that Hamlin had not died that night, and he was in expert medical care. All right. Now, unfortunately, people die all the time. We've had sporting events where people have died, and those sporting events have gone on in some way, shape, or form, sometimes without even being stopped. Now, this had not happened, anything like this had not happened in the NFL since 1971, but we've had numerous circumstances where people were paralyzed very, very seriously, and the game went on with effectively no postponement at all. And so what should have happened, and this sounds like 2020 hindsight, but to me, this is something that should have been talked about immediately, but you couldn't talk about it because the media environment and the social media environment made it impossible, because people were getting crushed like Skip Bayless for even questioning whether or not the game should go on, as if the game going on was going to have an impact over whether Hamlin survived or not. It would have any impact over his ultimate result of surviving this cardiac arrest, which, of course, is ludicrous. I mean, you can do two things at once, And I fully acknowledge that seeing that would be very, very difficult to go on with playing a football game. So what should have happened was the commissioner steps in and says, this is a horrible situation, but you know, we are up against the clock here with regard to scheduling. This was obviously a very important contest, and we are going to reschedule for whatever, 1 o'clock Tuesday afternoon. You could have given the teams the option to not play. You want to forfeit? Go ahead and forfeit. But we have to finish this game because it's very important to the rest of the season. And we're going to give people time to gather their thoughts, and hopefully Hamlin will stabilize. You know, if by 1 o'clock the next day Hamlin had died, you could have postponed it again or canceled it at that time. But the game should not have been canceled. And the reason why it was canceled was because of ESPN and the general environment of the media, and specifically social media. Because social media is so driven by virtue signaling and so dominated by woke culture. And once this idea got cemented that it would be inappropriate to play, and I logically, I just don't even understand how that's the case. Not only because it has no impact over Hamlin's recovery, but okay, so what's the statute of limitations? When are you allowed to start playing again? I mean, there's games Saturday. So why can we play Saturday or Sunday and not on Tuesday? What is the difference here? But this is the world we now live in now, where we have mob rule by emotion. And this is also why it's way more important. I want to make this clear. Part of the reason why I'm talking about this is way more important than just what happens with the NFL playoffs. I mean, look, I'm nowhere near the NFL fan that I used to be. I still care somewhat about it, mainly because there's nothing else to capture my attention. I don't know if I'll still be a fan in a few years when I won't even know any of the players because I haven't been following it closely enough to have any connection to any of them. But the reality is I pay attention. But here's why it matters. The NFL is humongous. It's by far the most popular sport. You could argue it's the most popular event that occurs in any given year in the United States. Obviously, the Super Bowl is the biggest event that occurs. So what happens in the NFL has impact not just for NFL fans. It has impact with regard to what kind of society we're going to live in. If only on a subconscious level, it helps to create rules or guidelines or standards. I mean, taking this out of the theoretical and into a more practical situation, what I believe the NFL did here, which was to change their rules literally in the middle of the game because of this cancellation, I think will seep in to the consciousness of much of the country when it comes to things like our laws. You know, we're a country of laws, not men, for a reason, or at least we're supposed to be, because men are, and women obviously, are subject to biases and emotions. And you can't be making big decisions in an emotional environment because, one, there's going to be ramifications for that. You're going to create bad precedents. And down the line, it's going to come back to haunt you. So that's the whole concept of the law mattering. Well, if you think of the NFL as a de facto government institution, which it kind of is. I mean, that's how big it is. And heck, they did a heck of a job carrying the government's water on the COVID restrictions, restricting crowds, masks, vaccines, the whole bit. They were effectively a government institution, the NFL was, especially during COVID. But if you think of it that way, the NFL abandoned the entire concept of being ruled by law. They changed their own rules. Now, it's very complicated, and it may or may not end up mattering, but there's still a decent chance that it will matter. Effectively, what happened here was that because they had canceled this game, they had to come up with this convoluted way of configuring the playoffs, and specifically what happens in a potential AFC championship game with regard to home field advantage. And the bottom line is that the team that the Bills were playing, the Cincinnati Bengals, was the team that ended up getting most screwed by this. Now, again, we don't know how screwed, if at all, they will eventually be. The NFL dodged a bullet with regard to the way that the final results came out on Sunday and the way the playoff pairings are. So the Bengals haven't been screwed yet. But you could, you know, there's still a decent chance that the Bengals are going to get the raw end of this deal. So much so that they were even willing to talk about it publicly, which surprised me because I thought, my gosh, with the level of virtue signaling going on here, they're never going to be willing to complain about this because it's going to be seen as sour grapes. It's going to be seen as somehow besmirching DeMar Hamlin's legacy. Which I don't even know how the hell that would be the case, but I mean, that's the level of sensitivity that was in existence here. And even despite that environment, the Bengals were willing to say, this sucks. This is wrong. And they were right. Because what should have either happened was if they weren't going to play the game, then the other option would be, okay, Bills, you forfeit. You were losing the game. You know, you were basically the team that didn't want to play. The Bengals went along with that because they were trying to be nice guys. Or they could have gone by the rules, which was an emergency situation. You go by winning percentage. Well, none of that happened. That got thrown out the window. And, of course, it wasn't the Bills that were going to get screwed because that would be somehow an affront to DeMar Hamlin. I mean, DeMar Hamlin's become the most important person in the world all of a sudden, and nobody's, you know, unhappy about the fact that it looks like he's going to survive, but this has gotten completely out of all sense of proportion. And so I was very disturbed by what the NFL did, and it's really remarkable what the NFL and its media conglomerates, its media partners have done in order to try to distract from the other issues that could be involved here with regard to, like, for instance, what the hell happened to DeMar Hamlin. I mean, think about what the media partners of the NFL have tried to tell their viewers in an effort to justify what the NFL has done here. Number one, they have said, these games don't really matter. No. It's what DeMar Hamlin's what matters. The games don't matter at all. They're meaningless now. Oh, okay, really? So this multi-billion dollar business is based upon games that don't matter? Okay, that's interesting. And then now, because of this convoluted fix the NFL created, they're now having to tell their fandoms, the NFL fandom and the media partners, they're now carrying water on this idea that, oh, by the way, home field advantage is meaningless. Completely. No one cares about home field advantage. This was particularly bizarre on Sunday Night Football. I was watching the pregame show, and every member of the cast universally said, oh, this is no big deal. Ha, ha, ha. They were like, you know, cackling like schoolgirls over how funny it is that anyone would care about where the AFC Championship game would be played because home field advantage means nothing. They don't care where they play. Oh, really? So then why are we selling tickets? Why are fans going to games? And by the way, the game that you're promoting this Sunday night is being played at Lambeau Field in Green Bay, which is the most historic and allegedly greatest home field advantage in all of football. Talked about all the time that the field is literally a character in the show. Lambeau Field, home of Vince Lombardi. It's outside in the cold. Tough to beat Green Bay in Green Bay. Of course, Green Bay lost and they didn't make the playoffs. But, you know, despite what I'm sure the NFL wanted, because that would have meant Aaron Rodgers making the playoffs, but that's another story for another day. The reality is it's hilarious that the media is having to step all over previous narratives, how important these games are and how important home field advantage is, all in order to try to put lipstick on the pig of what the NFL has done with regard to the response to the DeMar Hamlin collapse. And then the third part of this equation, which I find really interesting, and that gets us to the issue of what the hell happened, is that the NFL and its media partners is now getting behind this unproven, completely unproven notion that this happened as a regular course of playing football. So in other words, not only do the games not matter, not only does home field advantage no longer matter, but oh, by the way, this is a sport where you can die on the field because you get a routine hit to the chest during a tackle. That's the position now of the NFL media partners, because that's been the narrative. And by the way, Dr. Fauci is backing up this narrative. We'll get to him momentarily. But think about how much they're giving up here in order to protect the Damar Hamlin narrative. They're giving up everything. They're giving up the whole house, the whole shop, the whole everything. They're giving away everything in order to maintain this narrative. And I find it almost hilarious as far as the last part of this. Okay, what the hell happened? And did this really happen because of an impact to the chest that seemed to be awfully normal? I don't know. It doesn't seem to me like that makes sense. I don't know what the alternative explanation would be. Obviously, the mind immediately, if you're rational and you're not biased, goes to the idea, well, could this be related to the vaccines? I'm a big believer in what you do not hear in these kind of situations is as important as what you do hear. And there are two things we have not heard, at least as of this taping, Monday morning, West Coast time, and I think we would have heard either of these things by now if they were true. But we have not heard either of the following two things with regard to Damar Hamlin. We have not heard a report that, oh, by the way, he wasn't vaccinated. Okay, we would have heard that, folks. If he was not vaccinated, that would have gotten reported in some way, shape, or form by somebody. That would have leaked out because there would have been an incentive for the league to have that be known. But that's not happened. Now, it was pretty obvious to anybody that he was vaccinated because almost everybody in the league is vaccinated because the league, while it doesn't have a mandate, has effectively a mandate. They make it almost impossible for you if you're not vaccinated. And they do a heck of a lot of you know, trying to motivate people into getting vaccinated, if not blackmailing them into getting vaccinated. And so I never had any doubt that whether it was relevant or not, that Hamlin was vaccinated. But if he was not, we would have heard that. We have not heard that. Maybe even more importantly, we have not heard anything about bruising on his chest. Because when it comes to this comedia cordis situation, which is what everyone latched onto, everybody in the medical community immediately latched onto because they didn't want this to have anything to do with the vaccines, then it has to be comedia cordis. Well, that is a sharp impact right to the heart. Well, that usually, from what I have read, includes bruising, because usually it happens with a baseball hitting someone right in the chest. And to my knowledge, there's been no reporting of any bruising in his heart area, on the chest area. So that doesn't disprove it, but that would be something that would absolutely leak out if it existed, because that would go to the theory that the conventional wisdom, lack of better term, usually not right, conventional wisdom, that's what the establishment wants everyone to believe. The establishment wants it to be comedia cordis because that eliminates the issue of the vaccine potentially causing that. Of course, I still don't understand why that's in the NFL's best interest, because if that's true, then my God, football is far more dangerous than even I ever thought. Even though we've never seen anything like this before, a fairly normal tackle, a hit to the chest where you're most protected, can cause you to go into cardiac arrest live there on the field. And so, you know, I find this to be interesting and important. I still don't know what the hell happened, but Dr. Fauci says he knows what happened, which automatically makes me suspicious that that's not the case, because Fauci has been wrong about almost everything, and he has a massive, 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 massive conflict of interest here. This clip is fascinating that we're about to play for you. This is from CBS. This is Major Garrett interviewing Dr. Fauci. Now, there's so many different things that I think are important about this clip. The first is the fact that Garrett very, very tepidly sort of kind of asks Fauci about the issue of the vaccines and whether or not they could have been related to the collapse and the cardiac arrest of Hamlin is how, and you'll be able to hear this. It's better if you watched it, but you can still hear it. In fact, you'll hear silence. Rather prolonged silence, is how tentative Garrett is to even ask the question. But the fact that he's even asking the question, sort of, is remarkable, because this has been the third rail. This is as toxic an issue as you can possibly get in the mainstream news media. This is the topic about which we shall not talk. This shall not ever be mentioned. And this is the power of Twitter, the power of Elon Musk's takeover of Twitter, the power of the Twitter files. By the way, there's supposed to be a Fauci file sometime this week, finally coming out on Twitter. This is the power of Joe Rogan. This is the power of Bill Maher. By the way, how bizarre is it? If I had told you that the heroes of the counter narrative of the pandemic would be Elon Musk, Joe Rogan, and Bill Maher, you could have gotten a lot of money on that bet. But this question, quote unquote question, is a testament to the power of Twitter, Elon Musk, Joe Rogan, and Bill Maher, because without them, there's no chance that Major Garrett feels compelled that he has to at least raise the issue, even if he's doing so in incredibly timid fashion, not really asking the question. And as you'll hear here in a second, even ask the question in such a tentative way, almost a fearful way, he's telegraphing to Fauci, look, I'm not going to really push you on this. You go ahead and lie whatever you want to do. Just say something. But I feel like I have to do this. I'm not going to push you. So feel free to go ahead and spew whatever BS you want to spew. But I feel some sort of obligation. And I'm also going to signal my own virtue by letting everyone know my personal disgust that I feel I have to ask this question. So here is Major Garrett talking with Dr. Fauci, who somehow knows that the vaccines are not to blame for Hamlin's collapse, but that it was the impact to the chest that did so. And I'll have some thoughts after you listen to this.
Dr. Fauci, I don't know if you saw it, but on Monday Night Football this week, DeMar Hamlin, a player for the Buffalo Bills, collapsed on the field. You're not an NFL expert, and you're not an expert on any cardiovascular issues the player might have had. But what I want to ask you about, Dr. Fauci, is, as I want to do in moments like that, I kept an eye on Twitter. And I can't tell you exactly how many minutes transpired, but it was less than 20 before people on Twitter began to say, well, clearly the vaccine caused his seizure. And that had a multiplier effect on Twitter, as these things tend to do. What's your reaction to that?
Well, my reaction is one of concern about...
Isn't it horror? Borderline more than concern?
Yeah, it's horror that misinformation and disinformation, when you have a platform like social media that exponentially spreads in its best form, proper and important and value-added information can spread, which is good.
Yes.
The thing as a public health person and as a physician and a scientist, and my identity as a physician is the thing that gets pained the most by that. Because what that means, Major, is that yet again another conspiracy theory, complete nonsense, is going to have some people make a decision for themselves and their family not to get vaccinated, which may cost them their lives. So that's the thing that's so horrible about it. And if you want to go out spouting nonsense, conspiracy theories, and spreading it all around, fine, except if it results in a person suffering and perhaps dying. And that's what happens when disinformation disincentivizes people to get proper interventions for a threat like a pandemic.
And in some of these instances, as you well know, Dr. Fauci, there is some shred of evidence myocarditis was related to vaccines. It is a heart issue. I'm not a doctor. You are. That's a shred,
right,
of evidence.
A very small shred, right.
And explain how then this can get conflated.
Of course. In a very, very rare case, some of the mRNA vaccines can cause a self-limiting, almost invariably benign, inflammatory response in the heart, which generally resolves in a very short period of time. It is very, very rare. When you compare that with the negative effects on the heart by myocarditis or pericarditis, which is inflammation of either the heart muscle or the covering of the heart, and heart failure and heart medical problems, overwhelmingly COVID itself causes that in a dramatically higher rate than the relatively benign, mild myocarditis that you might have with a vaccine, which is very, very rare. So that little thread of proof is that is it possible that he was vaccinated? And the fact is, someone came out, and I just read this, I haven't validated it, but I've read that some physician came out and made the incorrect statement that he had just vaccinated this football player a week earlier to add to the conspiracy that he was recently vaccinated, and therefore that's why he collapsed on the field. When if you look at the film, it's clear that he had a very big, strong person's shoulder go into his chest, which clearly can cause a traumatic injury to the heart. And yet the conspiracy theory about this related to vaccine, you're right, it spread all over.
And that's been something you have been living with and living through the entire COVID process.
Now, there is so much to say about Fauci's comments there. But the first thing I want to point out is regarding this issue of COVID versus the vaccine. And what Fauci said is factually accurate. And I said this in episode 21 of the podcast. You know, it's just as possible, if not more so, that Hamlin could have been impacted by having had COVID. His heart could have been impacted by having had COVID as it would be him being impacted by having been given the vaccine. However, Fauci uses a truth to create a lie or a distortion. And this is an important distortion because inherent in his comments is the very strong implication that, well, the minor risk of the vaccine to the heart is irrelevant because it's less than that of getting COVID. And so if you think about this, you go, oh, okay. So what you're saying then is that it's a risk, but it's a smaller risk than actually getting COVID. But the problem with that is the vaccine doesn't stop you from getting COVID. If it did, that disparity would be relevant. It would be highly relevant because then you would be able to say, oh, while this is a risk factor of the vaccine, it's lower than the risk of getting COVID. And so if the vaccine stops you from getting COVID, you're actually at a lower risk than you would be than if you were just getting COVID. That's the implication Fauci's putting out there, but he doesn't make the full connection. Of course, Major Garrett doesn't make that connection. The follow-up question should be, well, Dr. Fauci, okay, but it's still a risk. It's a risk that's being added on. See, Fauci's trying to do some funny math here. He's trying to pretend that because the risk is theoretically, we don't know this for sure, but I'll even grant him this for the sake of argument, that the risk is lower from the vaccine than it is from getting COVID, that somehow that makes it okay. No. You're adding on to the risk. You have the risk to the heart of getting COVID, and now you're adding more risk by getting the vaccine. And it's people, men, right in the age group of Damar Hamlin, who have been most at risk here. And by the way, it's not just myocarditis. There's also the issue of blood clots, which seems to be getting forgotten here. Again, I don't know whether or not any of this has anything to do with what happened to Damar Hamlin. I do not know. But I believe we should be asking the questions. And I do not believe that Dr. Fauci knows that this was Chlamydia Cordis. I believe Dr. Fauci desperately wants this to be Chlamydia Cordis. And I do not trust him. I've never trusted him from the beginning. He's a narcissist. He's a bit of a fraud. He's been wrong throughout his entire career. He loves being loved by the news media. And he hates admitting he was ever wrong about anything. And so I do not trust him at all. And I try to fight my own biases that I inherently believe he's almost always going to be wrong. Just because he says it's Chlamydia Cordis doesn't mean it wasn't. But I would like there to be some evidence. And by this point, I think there should be some evidence that it was Chlamydia Cordis. Instead, I don't think we're ever going to know. I said that in episode 21. I don't believe we're ever going to know, partially because Hamlin's going to live. And there's not going to be an autopsy. And there's not going to be the same kind of impetus to find out what the hell happened here. And I think the NFL is breathing a massive sigh of relief here. I mean, the NFL turned what could have been a complete catastrophe into a PR coup. I mean, by this, everyone rallying around DeMar Hamlin. I mean, it's just, it's been unbelievable. I mean, the DeMar Hamlin avatar, the number three avatar, has replaced the Ukrainian flag. I'm convinced that someone's going to do a study that shows if you wear a number three jersey, it helps prevent COVID better than a mask does. I mean, Hamlin has basically become like masking. If you don't wear a mask, if you don't praise Hamlin, you're somehow a bad person. Although, wouldn't it be amazing? Wouldn't it be amazing? This is, there's no chance of this happening. But wouldn't it be amazing if Hamlin started to feel his own suspicions as to what caused this and concluded that it was the vaccine? How quickly would the news media turn on DeMar Hamlin if he became an anti-vaxxer? Oh my gosh, that would be hilarious to watch. But there's no chance of that happening because Hamlin now has way too much to lose. He's now a superstar. He has been not just embraced by the entire establishment. I mean, he is a hero of the entire establishment. And so I don't think we're ever going to find out what really caused this. I do think it's interesting to note that if this had occurred under different circumstances, I think the entire media narrative would be different. Like, for instance, what if this had happened in pregame warmups instead of live during the game? I got to believe, especially if there was no video, I got to believe everything about this is different. There's nowhere near the level or the intensity of the virtue signaling. There's a little bit, there's not the emotion of having seen someone collapse live on television. What if this had happened during a game on a Sunday afternoon when 10 other games were going on at the same time and it only had local broadcast coverage live? I think that would have been completely different too. And the media environment, the media reaction would have been different. You would have been at least been able to talk about continuing the game or rescheduling the game. But you couldn't do that because 25 million people thought they saw someone die live on television. And they had an understandable emotional reaction and connection to that. In a little bit, I'm going to talk about Prince Harry. And I'm convinced that the entire Prince Harry phenomenon still goes back to his mom's wedding and her death. Because two generations of American women were convinced they saw, you know, they attended her wedding on live television back in the early 80s. And then, you know, they went through her death of a car accident in 1997. That's what drives to this day the Prince Harry thing. Well, it's somewhat similar with Hamlin. 25 million people saw that broadcast in some way, shape, or form. And so 25 million people are hooked on the story. And in a fragmented age, 25 million people is a ton of people. And that has a massive impact on how the news media is going to respond to any particular thing. Now, I said we're never going to know what really caused it, but of course, there's all sorts of people willing to put out their theories. Most of the medical establishment, of course, desperately wants it to be chlamydia gordis because that has nothing to do with the vaccines. But the most hilarious theory on what happened comes from Scientific American. Scientific American, this is what has happened to science in the post-COVID era. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a headline in Scientific American. DeMar Hamlin's collapse highlights the violence black men experience in football. The quote-unquote terrifyingly ordinary nature of football's violence disproportionately affects black men. That's a headline in Scientific American. Now, first of all, any rational person knows that's ridiculous, that the violence is not somehow racist. We don't know for sure that the violence had anything to do with what happened to Hamlin. That's number one. But number two, there's a very, 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 very obvious explanation for any disparity between the violence experienced by black men in football and the violence experienced by white men in football, especially at the highest levels, at the NFL level. It's very easily understood because the game is, one, dominated by black men. So inherently you have far more black men than you have white men. That's number one. But even if you can take into consideration the obviously disproportionate number of black people as opposed to the level of the population that is black, which is 13.4% in America, even if you take that into account, within football itself, where are the positions where white men are still viable? White men are still viable on the offensive line, kicker, punter, and as pocket quarterbacks. Well, you could very strongly argue that the safest positions to play, especially in the modern era of NFL football, are offensive line, kicker, punter, and pocket quarterback because they're so protecting the quarterbacks these days. So inherently, the positions that are most at risk for the impact of violence are the skill position players, the line, and also the linebackers. So you've got the secondary, the linebackers, the wide receivers, and the running backs, almost all of whom are black. It has nothing to do with racism. It has to do with the nature of the game itself. And but that's the way the media now works. Scientific American, I'm sure, got a lot of play for this, so they've gotten mocked on the right for this particular story. But any story, you know, any angle involving Hamlin was going to get lots of clicks over the last week because it's been by far the biggest story of the week, or maybe even, you know, may end up being the biggest story of the year, depending on how things go for the rest of this year. But obviously the story of the month. And it, you know, where it goes from here, I'm not so sure. I do not believe that we're going to find out what really happened. I think that part of the overreaction and the over-embrace of Hamlin has been, at least subconsciously, to distract from the issue of what the hell happened. And I think everyone's very relieved that because he didn't die, we were never going to be forced to find out what the heck really did happen with Damar Hamlin. But perhaps the biggest issue that Major Garrett completely ignores and drops the ball on, which should be the immediate follow-up to this entire line of questioning, is the issue of excess deaths. Because Fauci tries to pretend that, well, there's some minor evidence that, you know, the vaccines do cause a heart ailment, but again, it's not as big as COVID. And I've already explained why that is very deceiving and irrelevant to the dangers of the vaccine, especially for a very healthy athlete who has no real fear of COVID. The issue of the excess deaths has been totally and completely ignored throughout the world, but especially here in the United States. Now, in Great Britain, they're starting to catch on to this. I saw a major report in the United Kingdom a few days ago where they talk about, wow, there are a lot of excess deaths in the data that cannot be explained by COVID, but we just don't have an explanation for it. Oops. Well, you know, that's basically the attitude of, well, you know, nothing to see here. It's weird, but move along, people. Please move along. That's essentially the tone of it. But these numbers are not minor, and they're not just in the UK, and they're here in the United States as well. Let me give you an example. Now, it takes a couple of months for the data to be completely compiled by the CDC. But if we go back to mid-October here in the United States, the number of expected deaths was exceeded by a significant margin. 113% of deaths occurred in middle of October, the week of October 15th. 113%, which, by the way, has been very consistent over the last several months, right around that number, every single week, 113% of expected deaths. Now, of course, we are still dealing with the COVID pandemic, and people are still dying of and with COVID, except there's a big problem. That particular week, which was pretty normal, just over 2,000 people died either with or of COVID. And we all know that anybody that can be counted as a COVID death is being counted as a COVID death. So there's no chance that there's a significant undercount of COVID deaths within that just over 2,000 number. But if you take the number of deaths, which was just over 59,000 across the United States of America, and you do the basic math, and it's 113% of normal, that means that we had about, depending on how you interpret the numbers, we had at least 6,000 more deaths than would have been expected normally. Well, do the math on that. 6,000 minus 2,000 for COVID, which is the only thing you could blame these excess deaths on that's new or different than has ever existed previously, that still leaves you with 4,000 deaths. And this is not an unusual week. I'm just using this week because that's the most recent week that I'm confident that all the data has been compiled for. this has been pretty darn consistent with some little bit area of variance. In fact, what's been really odd about the percentage of excess deaths is it's been remarkably consistent. It's almost always right around 112, 113, 114, right around there. And you know, there's normal variance because the expected death number isn't an exact number. It's based upon historical norms and the time of year. It changes week to week based upon the time of year, flu season, what have you. So what's the explanation for the other 4,000 deaths? Now, I am not suggesting that it's the vaccines. I don't know. But if you look at this, again, correlation is not causation. But if you look at this, what's the biggest change that has happened in the last 2 years with regard to health? Well, a vast majority of the population is vaccinated. So inherently, you ought to at least ask the question, okay, could this be possibly leading to excess deaths? And of course, we also have evidence that these excess deaths are coming from people that are far younger than normal with no rational explanation. The scientific community, the medical community is just basically either putting up their hands in confusion or just ignoring the question altogether. And this is a big deal. I mean, 4,000 deaths in 1 week that are unexplained by historical norms ought to be causing the media to ask questions, especially when this whole died unexpectedly phenomenon continues to gain traction, especially on social media. And I am somebody who is very much against coming to conclusions based upon anecdotal evidence, especially in a country with over 300 million people. You're going to be able to find examples of anything you want. I mean, this is what the climate change people do. You know, they use anecdotal evidence to try to create this narrative that the man is destroying the environment. We're all going to die. So I don't agree with it there. And I don't agree with it when it comes to unexpected deaths. In fact, most of these unexpected deaths, I don't even share on social media because inevitably there is some theoretical explanation that has nothing to do with the vaccines. So what is going on? I don't know. Could it be a combination of factors? Oftentimes when there's a mystery, you have multiple explanations. Could there be an increase in suicides? Could there be an increase in situations where because of the pandemic shutdown, people didn't get the proper medical care and now they are dying because of that, whether it's because of cancer or what have you? Could the vaccines be playing a role in that? Or blood clots related to the vaccines? I don't know. But I do know the news media should be asking questions. I do know that Major Garrett should have asked Dr. Fauci this question because there is the implication that somehow there's no data to support any suspicions or cynicism or questioning in this area. And that's just not the case. There's plenty of data. The media is just either ignorant or just choosing to ignore it because it doesn't fit their narrative and it's too scary. It's too scary. And I really think that's a lot of what drove the whole media narrative regarding Damar Hamlin. I think subconsciously, the media was freaked out about the implications of, oh crap, what if this really was the vaccine? Could this be something that's way, way, way bigger than Damar Hamlin? And that's partially why they were so excited that he's going to be okay, because they think it's going to get them off the hook for coming up with a rational explanation, which it very well may do. That doesn't keep them, of course, from coming up with bogus explanations, which they have done here. Now, as I mentioned just a moment or two ago, Prince Harry is making the rounds to support his book called Spare. Here in the United States, he's done interviews on 60 Minutes with Anderson Cooper and bizarrely with Michael Strahan on Good Morning America. The idea that Michael Strahan, former New York Giant defensive lineman, is interviewing Prince Harry on Good Morning America is just beyond bizarre to me, but that's the media world in which we now live. But Prince Harry, obviously the son of Princess Diana, the brother of Prince William, who's the heir to the throne of the British monarchy, has been going on a media tirade. First, he and his wife, Meghan Markle, put out this multi-part Netflix $100 million series about how much they really prize their privacy, which is effectively what the narrative is. I've watched the whole thing. My wife is very much into the royals, as a lot of women are. And while it may seem as if I'm not the kind of guy that would have a lot to say about the royal family, bizarrely, I do. One, because I have a wife who's very into it. I have daughters named Diana and Grace, Princess Diana, Princess Grace. And also, I think I should point out that while I had a sister who was very much into the whole Princess Diana thing, having grown up in the 1980s, I have a bizarrely similar biography in this realm to Prince Harry and Prince William. And that is that my mother was also killed in a car accident with her boyfriend just after having gotten divorced from my father, who ended up remarrying the woman that he was cheating on my mother with. I mean, I hope that all made sense, but that's exactly the same situation that happened with Harry and William. Obviously, I'm not a prince, but I do think, and while I was a little bit older, I was in my 20s when that happened, as opposed to 12 years old when Harry was 12, when his mother was killed in that car accident in Paris with her then boyfriend. And, you know, while I was older, I still think I have at least a little bit of an understanding of the psychology of what has gone on in his life. And there's no question that's a lot of what's driving Prince Harry, but this is a podcast about journalism and the media. And while it may not seem significant, I believe that the Prince Harry story tells us a lot about how the news media works or doesn't work and how journalism is really in a state of dramatic decline. And there's several elements of this story that are related to the news media. The first is, okay, so why does the American news media care so much about Prince Harry? Why? Well, the answer is because so much of the American public cares. Okay, so why does so much of the American public care about Prince Harry? I mean, he's barely a member of a royal family in another country that has, that's basically just symbolic now. They have no real power. Why would we care? And it makes no sense. Well, America obviously has a complicated relationship with Great Britain, having had fought a revolution against Great Britain well over 200 years ago. You would think that we would have some level of disdain for Great Britain, but in reality, we have some sort of envy, I think, some level of insecurity. I think we some level of national insecurity towards Great Britain. Plus, I think we love the whole concept of royalty. We try to create our own royalty here in America called celebrities. And so it might be just the kind of human nature. But I believe the major reason, putting all that I just said aside, which is, I think, part of the equation, but it's not nearly the full equation. The main part of this equation is Princess Diana. Princess Diana drives everything here because two generations of American women believe that they attended her wedding live on national television in an unprecedented television event. And then they went through her life, her marriage, her having kids, her divorce, and then being killed in a car accident. And if you remember, if you were alive at the time in 1997, the news media actually got castigated at first for not taking the story seriously enough. That was, I think, a seminal moment in the history of the American news media and in journalism. Because the American news media back in 1997, when she was killed in that car accident, looked at this and said, well, she's not even a member really of the royal family anymore. She's not married to Charles. She's never going to be queen. She's someone who's known, and her death is significant, but it's not worthy of 24/7 live coverage. And yes, it happened over Labor Day weekend, and that played a role in this, but the American news media was late to figure out just how deep the level of passion and interest regarding Princess Diana really was in America. And they had to play catch up. And after that, they never played catch up again on this. And so it's really Princess Diana to this day that drives this. I've talked all the time about the power of 1970s celebrity, and used to joke with my now late friend Franco Harris about how his life was dramatically impacted by the fact that he was a 1970s celebrity, and you can't beat 1970s celebrity, because at that time, you know, that was really the first time when all Americans had a television set, but there were only three or four networks. There was not much else to do. And so, you know, if you were really, really well known, you were famous in the 70s, you were famous forever because everybody knew who you were. Well, Princess Diana, even though she was a creature of the early 80s, she was so big that it was effectively the same thing. And the cable news thing hadn't happened yet. And so for all intents and purposes, she had 70s celebrity, even though it was birthed in the 80s. And that plays a huge role in all of this. If Harry was the son of Camilla Parker Bowles, who no one cares about because she's not attractive, she's not interesting, and he was trying to peddle the story of being the spare heir and, you know, all this dirty laundry with the royal family, the media wouldn't care. The media would not care if Harry had not been the son of Princess Diana, whose wedding was seen on international television and whose death was a huge deal. And if Harry was not the person walking behind that casket in that very emotional moment, again, seen by a massive American audience. I mean, effectively, Harry and William are like JFK Jr. was after the Kennedy assassination, the famous picture of JFK Jr. saluting his father's casket that was put together by his mom, Jackie Kennedy, which forever, I mean, he was a great looking guy, so he always would have been well known and a celebrity, but that put him in a different stratosphere. Well, that moment walking behind the casket was the same thing for Harry and William. So they become embedded in our national narrative, even though, you know, they're from Great Britain, although Harry now lives pretty close to where I do, in Santa Barbara, California, Montecito, very beautiful place. He's really roughing it there. And, you know, now he's got this book out where he's complaining about what a terrible life he's had. And I just want to make one comment about this, the global issue of the title spare. It's a clever title because there's an heir and a spare, right? But the reality of this is Harry won the genetic lottery by being a member of the royal family. Now, I realize it's not an easy task, but I mean, most people would feel pretty good that if that's where they ended up in life. But he just didn't win the $1 billion genetic lottery. He lost to his brother William because he was the first one. Well, it used to be when you looked at that and you go, wow, I'm really lucky. I'm a member of the royal family. And that's just the way the cookie crumbles. Sometimes you're the second born and that's just life. Well, now, you know, we don't look at things that way anymore. You know, I got ripped off by life because I was the spare and not the heir. I don't even understand how that works, but that's the way it is now. And kind of in a weird way, kind of like what I described with regard to the Speaker of the House saga, the Prince Harry saga is a little bit similar in that in our old media age, the spare would not have had this kind of media option. They would not have had a Netflix special. They would not have had the ability to write a book like this and go on all these different television news outlets. It wouldn't have been an option to them. And the family would have had the power to keep them in line, much like the political party used to have the power to keep a rogue congressman in line. The party has lost the power. The family has lost the power. And because Harry is the son of Diana, he has enough celebrity to get the American news media to dance to his tune. And boy, did they dance to his tune. I mean, Anderson Cooper's interview was a joke. Michael Strahan's interview was a bigger joke. No serious questions. I mean, if I was asking questions, one of the first things I would ask Harry, I would ask Harry probably about two things right off the bat. Number one, I would get to the bottom of this bogus claim that somehow there was a member of the royal family that was making racist jokes about how his son from Meghan Markle was going to turn out. And it was obvious from the Oprah Winfrey interview that that was a lie, that Meghan Markle was lying and that Harry was embarrassed by it because his story was very different from Meghan Markle's and Harry didn't want to talk about it. And Harry's never talked about it since that I can find, but no one asks him about that. That was a lie. And it was an obvious lie. The other part of that, speaking of lies, is having watched this Netflix special with my wife, it's very clear now that there are numerous clips, not just one by accident, but numerous clips in this Netflix series that are completely fabricated or fraudulently used. In other words, they are not from situations involving Harry or Meghan Markle. There are clips from other media scrums or chaotic situations involving the media where they have lifted those clips and pretended that that was the media going after Harry and Meghan Markle. Not true. It's been documented. At least 3-4 of these clips prominently used, having nothing to do with them. In one situation, they even try to make it look like a member of the media was going to great lengths to get pictures of their son, and it turns out that the photo that they used was from one of their own hired professional photographers. So the Netflix special is based, at least in part, in total fraud and manipulation. Will Harry be asked about that? Of course not. Of course not, because for whatever reason, he's untouchable. He's the son of Diana, and you know he's a celebrity, and they're probably all intimidated by him because he's a prince. How that's intimidating, I don't understand, but that's the way the media looks at things. And so, you know, it's a significant media story from the standpoint of what makes the American media tick. It's also interesting from a media standpoint, and Harry, I think, has a decent point. I mean, I kind of liked Harry before the whole Meghan Markle thing, and I think he's an intelligent guy. He makes a legitimate point about the symbiotic relationship between the tabloid media in Great Britain and the British royal family. And that's a complicated relationship where they're basically trading access for coverage, which tells you a lot about how the modern media works. I think Harry might have some misinterpretations of what's really happening. At one point in his Anderson Cooper interview on 60 Minutes, he tries to claim that Camilla Parker Bowles was doing him wrong in the British tabloids because the British tabloids were more beholden to her because she's the queen consulate. And I'm like, that's ridiculous. Camilla Parker Bowles has no leverage with the tabloid media. One, because she's not going to be a real queen. And two, because no one cares about her. She's ugly and not interesting. The tabloids care way more about Harry, especially now, because he's so controversial, but about the kids and about William. I mean, that's what they care about. It's not Camilla Parker Bowles. So I don't understand why Harry thinks that that's what happened. I think it's a bit conspiratorial and paranoid on his part. As far as what really is going on here, I believe it all goes back to Diana, not just from a media standpoint, but from a psychological perspective. I really do believe that Harry has never gotten over the death of his mother at the age of 12, and that psychologically, I think he's even found in Meghan Markle this new Diana in his mind. I mean, it's amazing the similarities between Meghan Markle in the narrative that Harry has created and his mother, only she's the black Diana. And this wokeness element of Harry is really disgusting. I mean, he's now called himself, he believes he was bigoted before he started dating Meghan Markle, as if this is proof that somehow you're not racist by having a wife who is partially black. By the way, it should be pointed out that Meghan Markle in her 2013 actress biography referred to herself as Caucasian. So, I mean, this idea that she's now a civil rights leader is beyond hilarious and so indicative of this bizarro world in which we now live. But I do think that it's the death of his mother that has driven everything about Harry. He blames the media, understandably so, for why she died. I do believe the media played a significant role in why Diana died. He's a bit more conspiratorial about it than I am. I think it was purely an accident, but it was obviously at least indirectly caused by the news media and the tabloid media going after her. If she had not been so popular, if she had not been beautiful, if there had not been such a hunger for information about her, she would still be alive today. I think that's pretty obvious, you know, obviously barring some other cataclysmic event. And so I think that motivates Harry in a lot of different ways. He's trying to somehow compensate for the death of his mother. He hates the media because of it. This is why he found Meghan Markle, who's in his mind the new Diana. And I think that that is really goes a long way in explaining a lot of his motivations here and his revenge on his family. Now, the revenge on the family part, my wife Allison believes, is all about Harry rationalizing his horrible mistakes and the outcome of all this. In other words, he's given up everything for Meghan Markle. So now he needs to rationalize why he was right in allowing that to happen. And I think there's something to that as well. I think that's a pretty good theory. I mean, that's the way human beings work. If you end up in a really bad situation, you're going to want to understand why that happened. You don't want to take blame yourself. Harry is not taking blame for anything. Meghan Markle's not taking blame for anything. No accountability for any of this has occurred. And the bottom line is Harry has lost his entire family. He's no longer really part of the royal family, only technically so, and has no relationship with his dad, no relationship with his brother. And he needs to rationalize this. He's given this all up for his wife, Meghan Markle, who I'm quite sure, if is not already the case, is going to grate on his nerves quite a bit in the next few decades. I will be stunned if this relationship does not collapse in 10 to 15 years, if not sooner than that. Because Meghan Markle is a piece of work. I mean, if you look at all this, what ended up happening? Meghan Markle got everything she wanted. Meghan Markle started before her relationship with Harry as an aging actress who was nowhere near A-list. She was about a C-list actress living in Los Angeles, who obviously wanted to be rich and famous, and it wasn't really happening. Well, where is she now? She's living just outside of Los Angeles. She's got kids. She's richer than she could possibly ever have imagined. She's more famous than she could ever possibly imagine, and she's extricated herself from having to deal with the whole royal family bullshit. So she got everything she possibly wanted. Fame, wealth. She's back in L.A. Now, she lost, you know, her father because she threw him under the bus for reasons that I don't fully understand. But, you know, Meghan Markle's the big winner in all this based upon what it seems like she wanted. And Harry appears to be the big loser. And I'm sure that that's part of what's motivating his revenge tour, that the media is all too willing to play a part of again. Because why? Because it'll get ratings, because Harry is the son of Diana and Diana is a patron saint of the modern news media. She is one of the very few people that reached a level that you can talk about at any time, in any way, shape, or form, and you're going to get an audience because there's that many people, that many mostly women, millions of women in this country to this day. All you have to do is mention Diana and people will tune in. They will stay tuned in because they are invested in that story, much like Damar Hamlin. That's really what it is in the modern media, getting people deeply invested in a story. It doesn't have to be that many people. It just has to be enough to sustain your business model, which in most situations is totally broken in the modern news media, which is why journalism is dead and why it is that we have this podcast, The Death of Journalism. Now, on the next episode, episode number 23, which should be out on Thursday, we are planning to do an interview with Mark Judge. Now, that name might not be familiar to you, but Mark Judge is the guy who was supposedly in the room with Brett Kavanaugh, Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh, when he allegedly assaulted Christine Blasey Ford. And this was the controversy that almost derailed the nomination process of Brett Kavanaugh. Well, he has written a book called The Devil's Triangle. I've gotten to know him a little bit over the last couple of years. His story is fascinating and goes right to the heart of why it is that the news media is completely and totally broken. And so unless something really huge happens, like Damar Hamlin coming out as an anti-vaxxer, we will be speaking with Mark Judge, as well as updating you on whatever else is going on in the world of media in our next episode, episode number 23. That'll do it for episode number 22. As is always the case, please remember to subscribe, rate, and review this podcast and share it with everyone you know, because obviously the media won't do that for us. And until next time, my name is John Ziegler. Thanks for listening to the Death of Journalism podcast.
Death of Journalism is a Workhouse Connect John Ziegler production. Executive producer Mike Agavino, with our hosts Liz Abib and John Ziegler. You can find The Death of Journalism wherever you get your podcasts. If you like us, please give us a 5-star rating and review. Please join our Twitter community, The Death of Journalism. Thanks for listening.